This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hello and thank you for downloading the Scotland Outdoors podcast. I'm Mark Stephen, here standing in a rather soggy car park in BBC Aberdeen, Mr. Ewan McElreath.
Yeah, I'm never quite sure if autumn has arrived with a wallop or we just missed autumn altogether and went straight to winter. A lot of strong winds here. The leaves, beautiful reds and browns and russets, but they've almost all been blown away.
But it's all lying on the deck now.
Yeah. A bit later in the programme, one of the great sounds of winter here in Scotland is the arrival of some magnificent birds. And I'm getting really up close to them a wee bit later.
Potatoes. For some reason, every time somebody mentions potatoes, you know, usually in broadcast terms, it says the humble potato.
That's compulsory, isn't it?
It's compulsory. You have to call it the humble potato. But The fact is, there's lots of varieties of potatoes. We are kind of dependent on potatoes. And diseases that affect potatoes, therefore, affect us.
Yeah, some of our favourite varieties, things like Maris Piper or King Edwards, they're under threat from blight. It's a real problem in the industry. It's constantly evolving, the diseases, so it means there's a whole warfare to try and get resistant varieties that may see us into the future. I headed to the Royal Botanic Gardens in Edinburgh to find out more from science communicator Max Coleman.
So the ones that we can see where the tops have been removed are versions of the cultivated potato. There are two different kinds here, and the reason that we've taken the tops off them is that they got blight in August.
What is blight?
Blight, it's a fungus-like organism, and it affects the foliage initially, and you get these black spots. And if it's not dealt with, it then spreads quite quickly into the potatoes on the ground, and they start to rot, and you lose your crop, essentially.
So was that what happened in Ireland?
That is, yeah. And in fact, the one that we can see at the front here, called Lumper, is the particular version of the cultivated potato that was very commonly being grown in Ireland at that time.
And that kind of rams home how vulnerable the Scottish potato crop is, because it's hugely important economically and as a food source.
That's right. The Irish potato famine was in the 1840s, and that was the first appearance of that disease. But ever since that point, both in Scotland and around the UK and elsewhere around the world where potatoes are being grown, it's been a problem, and it causes massive economic losses.
Every year we go through, or I go through, the seed catalogues, and you're looking for blight-resistant potatoes. You buy them, and they're still not hugely effective.
One of the issues is that the pathogen, the thing that causes the disease, is constantly evolving. So breeders, crop breeders, can produce something that is resistant now, but in 5 years' time might not be. So it's a constant job. It's like an arms race. You're constantly trying to stay ahead of the pathogen.
Now, we've got your plot here at the Botanic Gardens. Beautiful, beautiful demonstration plot of vegetables and flowers. It's great. Now, I'm looking at these ones that have had blight, and then there's some that very obviously don't have.
So these are what we call the Edinburgh potato, which is actually not such a daft name in a way, because it was named as new in 1911, and it was called Edinense, which is the Latinised version of Edinburgh. And it was called that because at that point in time, it was only known from this garden and nowhere else. And nobody really knew where it had come from. But it was known at that time to be disease resistant. And in fact, we've got records in our archive showing that it was being grown possibly from as early as the 1860s, so shortly after the Irish potato famine. And it showed resistance throughout that long period of time. So it's always been of interest to potato breeders, and it's actually gone on to be used in breeding programs to bring that resistance into a useful crop.
But where did it come from? Did it suddenly appear in 1911?
Its initial appearance in this garden is a bit of a mystery. What gradually became clear over time, and really the full picture didn't become apparent until about the 1950s. It's a plant that originates in Mexico, and it has quite an interesting origin, because it's a plant that's the product of crossing between two entirely different potato species. So it's what we call a hybrid. One of its parents is the cultivated potato, and the other is a wild Mexican potato, which has quite small tubers, the potatoes that we eat, and they're not really edible. The offspring, what we call the Edinburgh potato, has bigger tubers.
And this is the Mexican. How could suddenly a Mexican tatty appear in Leith?
Well, there are two theories there. So either somebody was plant collecting in Mexico and they collected some tubers, probably. They were then shipped back to Royal Botanic Garden Edinburgh, and they were grown in the garden, and that's how it arose in Edinburgh, direct from Mexico. The other possibility is that it could have arisen either in this garden or in another garden where the Mexican parent and the cultivated potato had been grown side by side, and just the activity of bees caused cross-pollination between the species, and then somebody grew some seeds collected off a fruit that had been produced, and that seedling turned out to be the hybrid. And so it's essentially a kind of recreation of something that's happening naturally in Mexico somewhere else.
Now, you hinted that the Mexican grandmother or mother of this potato doesn't taste very great.
No, the Mexican parent, which we've got on the end here, has very, very tiny tubers about the size of a pea. And I believe, I've never tried them, but I believe they can be quite bitter. And there's a toxin that is found in a number of members of the potato family that has this bitterness. And it's really not edible.
So you've got this one, potentially, that could be economically big, to put it mildly.
Well, it has been, actually. What we're doing here is, in a sense, we're recreating a little bit of our own history, because it's named after Edinburgh and we know it was growing here. We've recreated it by doing the crossing the two different species to create it. And we also know that it has been used on several occasions in breeding programs to create disease-resistant potatoes. So it's kind of telling a story for the public as much as anything about how plant breeders can improve crops.
And you don't know what this one tastes like? You don't know if there's any tatties under there?
No. We've actually just created it last year from crossing, grown it from seed at the beginning of this year, and we're just about to dig it up. And we've never seen the tubers. We've never tasted them. We don't know what it's going to taste like.
We're going to film it on Landward, and if you want to know what it tastes like, what it looks like, and if there's any, join us then.
Max Coleman from the Royal Botanic Garden in Edinburgh.
Yeah, I mentioned Landward there. That's a BBC television programme. But what actually happened, you don't have to watch the programme to see it. They dug them up. Mm-hmm. Nothing. Dug them
Zip.
Up. Nothing. Dug them up. Nothing. And he's only got a handful of plants. And they eventually got one. He says, is that it? And honestly, it's the size of a pea. Mm. It's lovely white colour. So we got about seven.
Uh-huh. And about the size of a pea.
Yeah, and it's difficult.
This entire crop would fit onto a tablespoon.
If you chuck them in a pan, you know, how long do you give one? So anyway, we gave them about just a minute each. But what was amazing, they were lovely, waxy, beautiful salad potato. Mm-hmm. And you would eat a lot of them if you had enough to make a good meal. But you know, it was great, the fact they've got disease resistance, you're going back in time, and it's got the potential to be scaled up, but it was a bit of a...
Well, they're going to have to be scaled up. That won't feed anybody.
It was a bit of an awkward moment when the cameraman's looking at his head. I can't see him.
I can see nothing.
No, but it certainly stimulated a lot of debate. Huge interest in Scotland in potatoes.
One thing that is not particularly common in Scotland, curiously enough, given the fact we've got an awful lot of coastline, and by an awful lot of coastline, I mean about 6,000 miles of coastline, 10,000 if you count the islands, we don't have a lot of sand dunes.
No, that's true. There's just a few really dominant ones on the east coast, mainly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, predominantly. But they're fascinating. They provide a natural defence against the sea, the home to umpteen plants and animals. At West Sands Beach at St Andrews, for a few years now, there's been a dune stabilisation programme, which has been employing some pretty novel methods. I went along there to meet countryside ranger Ranald Strachan.
On our left here, we've got the fabulous kind of stretch of sand dunes along West Sands and St Andrews. Major recreational beach, as you know, it's been featured in things such as like the Chariots of Fire.
That was a long time ago.
Many years ago, yeah. But it was revisited, I think, for the 2012 Olympics, so we get a bit of mileage out of that. But, I mean, it's a major landscape feature. You don't need to visit St Andrews. The once, come down to West Sands, turn onto the beach road and you're hit with an amazing vista looking up north towards the Cairngorms, and right in the fore is the sand dune system. So that's what we're kind of wondering next to just now.
When you talk about stabilising a dune system, I've always presumed that dunes are meant to be dynamic, they're meant to move. So what are you stabilising it against?
Well, it's a really good question, because the problem that we've got here is that we have such a narrow strip of sand dune. You're absolutely right that a normal sand dune system that had not been interrupted by man or the sea would have a capacity to grow landwards and to grow seawards. But because the beach is so busy on the one side, and obviously we've got the higher tides and we've got the threat of climate change, which, so, you know, that's what kicked the project off in the first place, was the storm surge. So we're getting that threat on the seaward side. On the landward side, we've got development that we can't really move because, you know, in the Edwardian times, it was fixed. And, of course, the other thing is the old course and the golf courses are quite important and they're quite
slightly
important sort of features. So we've got into a situation where we have a narrow strip of dunes which are effectively acting as the single coastal defence, almost like a soft wall. So the problem that we have with stabilising it, and Mark, you've got a really good point, because we don't want to over-stabilise it because it almost deadens the dunes.
Yeah,
they can't grow. But what we've found, which is really, really handy, since we stopped mechanically cleaning the beach, we got all the volunteers in, we put the dune fencing up. We've actually seen a huge, as you see here, as we're coming up to this bit, we've seen actually a big growth of the dunes naturally on a seaward side, which to some degree compensates for the stabilisation that's taken place inside.
The dune fencing you're talking about is that sort of basically the wooden stakes that are wired together. But aside from that, what other forms of stabilisation taken? You're using plants or anything?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we're using pretty traditional methods of sand stabilisation. In Scotland, they're actually quite uncommon. So we're doing recharges, which is we're going out at low tide, we're harvesting sand, we're bringing it to the dunes, and we're sculpting new sand dunes or filling hollows. And then what we do is we get volunteers in, good old happy volunteers, usually in midwinter getting frozen solid.
Smile.
Smile, absolutely. We take them up to the far north end where the dunes are very, very kind of robust and on a much more mobile system. So we harvest grasses from there, we bring them down, and we plant them over the actual sand that we've put in. So it does appear to be quite artificial, but if you look directly to the left, that dune there, that fence and that dune was actually put there in February last year. So that's that. You would never, everybody walking up past that, you would never notice that that was actually a manufactured dune.
It's indistinguishable from everything else that you can see on the left-hand side.
So that's the major invasive structural kind of thing we do. But we also do, for instance, one of the big projects that we've kicked off, I think we started in 2016. We put out a call for volunteered old Christmas trees. And not plastic ones.
No.
Natural ones. So, and we got, you know, a fairly good response. The first year, we got 150 dropped off. Interestingly, some of them were coming down at Boxing Day. You know, some people some people are desperate to get rid of
miserable swine.
Yeah, I know. So mine comes down on the 6th. So we got those down, and the idea was to look at where we'd had the particularly deep hollows. We could fill them with Christmas trees, which, in a way, they're already a natural trapper of sand, so as soon as the wind blows with a bit of sand, they're capturing it.
I would imagine they would lock together quite well, too.
They absolutely do. I mean, it's a cheap Scottish version of what the Dutch call a Dutch basket. They do it much, much neater. They have, like, lovely sort of almost like kind of squares with netting, and it's filled with brash. We just chuck Christmas trees in the hole. It's absolutely the same effect, and you're dead right. It knits together really, really well. So sometimes we have to cover it with sand, really just to get the process started. And actually what that will help do as well is over time is it will give a little bit of nutrient back into supporting the vegetation that we've replanted on the top.
How does this dune system actually connect to everything else around here? Or does it connect? Does it exist in isolation?
Oh, no, not at all. It's a massive geomorphological structure. So, you know, where we're standing, we're between the Tay Estuary and the Forth Estuary. If you look back in post-glacial times, this is where all this sand came from. And it all came down the Tay, came down the Forth, was dumped into the St Andrews Bay. And the wonderful thing for us is actually it operates on a huge cycle. So the sand basically, if it's blown off the land, it ends up in the sea. We do lose it for a while, but we don't lose it to the whole system. Longshore drift will take it up to the Tay, it then gets pumped out to the Abertay bands, and then it's recirculated by the North Sea back into the bay. I think there's a nice continuity about that. And one of the things that I'm often, I wouldn't say criticised for, but pulled up on, is that it's simply a defence for the golf courses. Well, yes, I don't apologise for that. It is, because the golf courses are important. I don't play golf, by the way, but I think they're important. But it's also intrinsically important habitat. Now, in Fife, we don't have that, although we're famous for our beaches in Fife, we don't have that much in the way of sand dunes. So I think even just the fact that it's sand dune is worth conserving it.
Ranulph Strachan at West Sands Beach. And as I said to him at the beginning, you know, it's a dynamic environment. How do you do this? And he's quite open about it. He says it's a balancing act.
Yeah, because I thought you weren't supposed to stabilise sand dunes. That's the whole point. It's dynamic. It's moving. Stabilising is bad for them.
I didn't know about that business of the cycle. You know, of the sand getting washed out one way, going all the way around, etc., and then coming back again, more or less.
Goes around, comes around.
Somebody should think of that as an expression. Wouldn't be a bad idea at all. You will not be putting your Christmas tree into a hole in the ground. Explain why.
No, because many years ago I decided keep the tree, take the branches off it, stick it in a shed, and then come the following Christmas, cut it into logs, and I start the first fire of Christmas morning with the logs from last year. Right. Not only recycled some, but it was that great sense of getting in touch with the past, thinking that the great
The ghost of Christmas tree past.
Yeah, ghost of Christmas tree past.
You told me about that a few years ago, and I've been doing it ever since, but I must confess, I take the branches off it and then cut it into logs and dry it that way.
Yeah. Well, I can't take it intact because I'd probably lose it otherwise, but if you could tell us what you do with your Christmas trees. A lot of people listening to this won't have Christmas trees at all, but you can email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. Now, this week I was confronted with an amazing sight. Right outside my kitchen window, I don't know outside you, but there's large numbers of swans around.
Yes, I've seen them. Yeah.
And as you hear in the light of the programme, I went out to try and get a wee bit closer, see if I could record them. But first of all, I wanted to know what they were, so I called in Richard Humpage, who's an old friend of the programme, and he works for the RSPB.
Most of them are hooper swans that have just joined us for the winter from Iceland.
And they've got that fantastic bugling is the only way I can describe it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they're very, very different and much more vocal to our mute swans, which everybody will be very familiar with.
So where are they coming from? Because they suddenly arrive. I'm in the Devon Valley. And you suddenly, kind of end of October, start of November, they arrive in big numbers.
Yes, they do. They've just had a very successful breeding season up in Iceland, and they're here for the winter.
They seem to come in huge numbers and also wee distinct groups. We're looking at a group of six up there at the moment in the field. Do they arrive as families then?
That's right, yeah. Mum and dad will bring their offspring with them and show them the migratory routes and so on and show them where to get the food when they arrive here. And then towards the end of the winter, those family groups will become less distinct and they'll tend to break up and then go back to Iceland next spring separately.
But they seem to be quite big groups, the family groups. There's quite a lot in there.
Some of them have done really well. We've noticed some family groups of up to eight, so mum and dad and six cygnets, which is fantastic. It shows they've had a really good breeding season. But, you know, you will also get groups of several families together. You know, you can have several hundred swans in one field if the food's particularly good.
So how are they doing? I was under the impression they're growing in numbers, but I was speaking to a farmer yesterday. He said in the 80s we'd see a group of five or six, presumably a family group. Now it's hundreds.
It does depend very much on where you are. I mean, the world population is increasing, so we are getting more and more birds coming. Certainly at the Lochstrath Beg, we're seeing numbers rise even faster proportionately than the population coming here as a whole. So this part of Scotland is getting more and more of them, and it's a fantastic thing to see, yes. But because you don't see them in one field one year, doesn't mean to say that the population has crashed. They're very fickle birds in that they won't come back to the same fields necessarily each year. They will come back to the same area, but they might move, you know, into a different valley, into a different field where the food is, they think, that much better that year.
It is one of the great wildlife sites in Scotland. I mean, folk are starting to, if you're not a farmer, it's a great sight to see thousands of geese taken off. But presumably folk are starting to come to Strathbeg, wherever, to see the swans now.
Absolutely, yeah. We've got about 1,300 hooper swans there at the moment, and 500 or 600 mute swans too. So there's a couple of thousand swans to look at there. And they, yeah, the geese is quite a spectacle when they take off in the morning. But, you know, the hooper swans, there's fewer of them, but they tend to be much lower. And you can really hear the wind whistling through the winds as they just come over your head. It's fantastic.
Because you can almost feel it. There was six came over the head here at my house yesterday morning. And you can almost feel the pressure of the wings as they come across. It's a great start to the winter.
Oh, it's a fantastic way, isn't it? Yeah, it's yeah, fantastic sight.
Richard Humpage of the RSPB. And coming up later, you get pretty close
get
to this.
Pretty place. Close. Trust me, stick with us. It is an amazing sound. It's wonderful.
Umpteen times I've been outside our house, you say working in one of the sheds or something like that, and you can hear the swans, not the swans cry, you can hear the creaking of the pinions going past. There's a, you know, it is like a slightly creaky gate.
To say later on, it's actually like the swallows arriving in spring.
Yeah.
The arrival of the whooper swans in autumn.
Yeah.
Kind of kicks off what? Here's winter. Happy days.
Now, what if you could feed livestock like cattle and sheep a feed made from material which has got a very low carbon footprint? It might reduce the methane produced by animals. You don't need to grow it on land. It doesn't require any fertiliser. It sounds pretty ideal. There's a current knowledge transfer partnership between the James Hutton Institute and something called Davidson's Animal Feed, and they're looking into just this thing. Laura Guthrie went to meet David Beattie, the project associate, in his lab at the Hutton Institute.
The plan for the project is that we can begin to use seaweeds in animal feeds. There is a history of use of seaweed in animal feeds, but the project, the angle that we're coming in from in this project is to try and use seaweeds that have high protein content. The idea behind that is that currently, animal feeds have got very high protein content. The majority of this is sourced from South America. So the thinking behind the project is that we can use locally sourced biomass, which can then go into the animal feeds, which has an eco-friendly viewpoint to it. It will also promote Scottish industries. The goal is that we can introduce as much seaweed to substitute the currently used ingredients as we can. And these are questions that are going to be answered over the course of the project. The next stage after the analytical stage of this project is to work out what animal feed inclusions we can use the seaweeds for.
So the stage you're at the moment is kind of analysing the seaweed to find out what's inside it, is that right?
Absolutely. So we start by finding just the protein, carbohydrate and lipid content of each seaweed, but then we'll go into more detail to really build up a clear and detailed picture of the biochemical profile of the seaweeds. In doing that, we can then start to try and formulate an animal ration which is both acceptable to the animal, because some feed ingredients, you include them at high rates, animals actually turn their nose up at them. You'd be surprised how picky farmyard animals can be. So one issue is that if we can't put these milled seaweeds straight into a pellet, if it has to be separate from the rest of the animal's diet, then they may actually omit that from their diet. So feed acceptability is a big factor. There is also the issue that ruminants have quite a complex digestive process, which means that when we come to formulating a ration and formulating a feed for the animal, there's a lot of trial and error that will be involved in making sure that we have a feed that is optimal, that is to the right nutritional standard, and that will also be enjoyed by the animals.
So you could think you've come up with the perfect thing. It's got everything that, you know, the cattle needs, and then basically it's just going to turn around and spit it out.
So, yeah, that's exactly it. We could have a feed that's very good for the animal, but the farmer puts it down and comes back half an hour later and the cows and the sheep haven't bothered to eat it. You can see where the issue would come from us as a feed supplier.
But we know that the animals do eat seaweed, and people will probably be thinking about sheep up in, is it Orkney, is that right? They naturally graze on the seaweed.
So you've got the North Ronaldsay sheep, as you said. They live on a diet almost solely of seaweed, which they forage from the coastline there. The animals that we use in the farm, they wouldn't really be able to cope with a diet like that. But there are a whole host of perceived benefits from the use of seaweeds. Some seaweeds, there's very good evidence that they act as quite strong prebiotics to the feed diet. There's some other evidence coming mainly from America that the use of some seaweeds, which we do get in Scotland, can significantly reduce the methane emissions that come from ruminants when they belch.
And that's a huge thing at the moment, that, you know, with climate change and things, that people are looking to tackle.
Absolutely. The environmental angle for this project is really, really promising. It's something that we want to exploit as much as we can. But these are areas that aren't actually very well defined at the moment. So ongoing research from others, as well as ourselves, will really help to put in focus what the possible benefits can be.
And we've obviously got a large coastline in Scotland. Could this be something down the line that we would be growing seaweed in a sort of aquaculture sense that would feed into this industry?
Absolutely. The industry in Britain, it's perceived that we can produce a lot more seaweeds, a lot more biomass from the coast than we already do. The biggest issues here are licensing issues. So at the moment, the majority of Scottish seaweed is produced through wild harvesting. In areas where this is currently taking place, we're kind of at the higher threshold of the amount of wild seaweed that we can collect. So moving on, most seaweed production that we use in Scotland, it will probably be from farmed sources.
And is that quite an eco-friendly thing to do if we were to start seriously kind of growing seaweed for harvesting?
Seaweeds are known to be very good harvesters of anthropogenic carbon dioxide, which means that they can absorb a lot more carbon dioxide from the surrounding atmosphere than terrestrial plants. Another benefit is that if we're to ramp up the production of seaweeds, they don't actually compete for water, or you don't need to give them fertilisers as you do with land plants. If we were able to devise ways of really ramping up the production of selected seaweeds, the benefits, they range from reduced water usage, reduced fertiliser usage, but there's also some evidence that if you use seaweed suitably around, for example, fish farms. From Scotland, we've got quite a strong fin fish farm industry, that they can actually be beneficial to the organisms that live in those farms.
And you touched on it earlier when we were talking about the sheep eating seaweed off the beach, that our farmyard animals wouldn't be able to eat it like that. So you're not talking about sort of just feeding them raw seaweed. What would you have to do to it in order for it to actually be turned into feed for them?
Well, this is the part of the project that we're working on at the moment. So basically, when we get the seaweeds in, they come in as you'd find them on the beach. What we do is we then freeze them. Following freezing them after 24 to 48 hours, we put them through a freeze-dryer process, which essentially takes all the moisture out of the seaweeds. If you look into this box, this is what the seaweeds look like when they come out of that freeze-dryer. They're very...
quite brittle.
They're very brittle, yeah. They crumble up quite easily, and they've got quite a strong aroma to them, if you want to smell that.
Definitely, yeah, it's very salty, very like the seaside.
You really can smell the seaside in a lot of them, exactly. So... once we've got them into that form, we need to then mill them, which essentially powders the seaweeds. You've done that, you find them in a really, really...
So it's like a very fine... It's like your, really you know, something powder. You find in your spice jar at home, basically.
Yeah, it looks to me, I always like to think it looks like sort of flour in different shades of green. Mm-hmm. That's exactly what it looks like.
It's a beautiful, vibrant green as well.
Yep, so some of the seaweeds, when we take them out, they've got a certain coarseness to them. So it looks similar to this, but it's almost as if the powder's granulated. So this is the powder that we do the majority of our biochemical assays and the rest of the work on. And this is really the starting point for just about all of them.
What are the next steps? When will you actually be able to trial out some feed on actual livestock? How far away is that?
So at the moment we're 6 months into a three-year-long project. We're maybe roughly 50% to two-thirds of the way through the initial analysis work. So all things going to plan, we'll be hoping to start formulating some feed rations within the next year.
David Beattie there, Knowledge Transfer Associate at the James Hutton Institute. It's an interesting idea.
Yeah, it's also making, as Laura referred to it, they've been feeding soy sheep up in Orkney for generations. Mm-hmm. And it's a big success. The problem is scaling it up. Uh-huh. Like anything, if you're going to start harvesting on a large scale to feed livestock, and it would be a large, large scale, can the seabed take it? Mm-hmm. You know, it's all very well to take one crop, but you need it to renew.
Yeah.
And it's early days. I mean, it's farming the seabed. And would it require fertiliser? You can't keep taking stuff out forever.
No, not necessarily. Anyway, we'll keep an eye on that. I don't know if you heard that there. There was a wren singing.
I can hear it robbing.
Yeah. Now that I want it to do something, it's not doing it at all. You're listening to the Scotland Outdoors Podcast. I'm Mark Stephen. He's Ewan McElriff. We do like hearing where you listen to these podcasts. We got contacted at outofdoors@bbc.co.uk by Valerie Castaneda. She says, "Howdy, Scotland. I live in sunny Arizona, USA, in a place called Tonto Basin. Besides being a place that's been continuously occupied by indigenous people for thousands of years, it's a wild place where numerous creatures live, and yes, we have lots of tarantulas. In defence of these docile creatures, they will only bite if you actually put yourself near enough to be a threat." I had one living in my yard all summer until torrential rain washed him out of his tarantula cave, but I've seen many since then when out walking. I can't speak for other spiders, but tarantulas really get a bad rap. Also, really love listening to your podcast, for Arizona couldn't be more different from Scotland. Gives me a chance to armchair travel, and that's Valerie Castaneda.
You couldn't have been more right today, just as you were saying, we live in sunny. There's a whole wall of water came down and just splattered off the car park.
I'm no expert on tarantulas, but I think it's true to say that after mating, the female
eats the male.
Kills the male. Yeah. And the male does this sort of, because she poisons him, essentially. Bites him, poisons him. Toxic bite. There's this sort of really agitated movement that they do, which is where the dance, the tarantella, came from. Allegedly.
You know, it's been worthwhile getting up this morning.
Yeah,
just,
I knew
just
it would
for
be.
That.
Yeah. Dinner parties,
all
big
over
cone
the
of silence. You all round about me.
You know what I heard on the radio this morning?
Yeah, afraid so. On this programme, certainly the live programme on Radio Scotland that we do Out of Doors, we've been looking at ways people, organisations, even places have been trying to become more eco-friendly, you could say. Now, our eye was caught recently by St Mark's Church in Dundee because they've been embracing a whole range of carbon-saving initiatives, including one idea that I think is particularly good. James Anthony is project manager.
This is St Mark's Church on Perth Road, which is in the west end of Dundee. It's a Grade A listed traditional church building, and we've got a slightly more modern attachment on the back, which is our community centre on Greenfield Place.
I have to say, it's a really handsome blonde sandstone building. Very attractive. Now, interestingly, this place, you're aiming to be the greenest church in Scotland.
That's right.
Let's talk about how, and then we'll get to why. But, I mean,
sure.
How?
How? Well, on a number of fronts, really. I guess the physical element of that is that we are installing energy efficiency measures to the building. Now, with a 200-year-old Grade A listed building, that does come with its challenges. But we're doing that to show that it's possible, really. So stuff like secondary glazing, insulation of walls, ceilings, underfloor spaces, efficient heating systems, and also, in addition to the efficiency stuff, also looking at renewables. So we have a 10 kilowatt solar PV system on our south facing roof, and the buildings now use 100% renewable electricity throughout the year. So what we don't produce on site, we buy from renewable sources. And we've been able to reduce our overall energy consumption by around about 80% from where we started, which is really quite a significant reduction, albeit over 8 years. But again, just trying to showcase what's possible.
This could be just money saving, but is there a religious aspect to this too?
Sure. I mean, we're a Christian church, and I guess the Bible talks about stewardship quite a lot. And it's climate justice, to me, is the big driving factor, because our collective actions around emissions impact, unfortunately, people in less affluent areas of the world in a more real way than the impacts we see here.
Most folk would think that a church operates on a Sunday.
It does, but the other 6 days of the week are just as important, really. So, you know, today, for example, we have an amazing team of volunteers in, all local residents helping with our Give Box project. Mm-hmm. So across Dundee, we now have 30 Give Boxes. You'll see those in supermarkets, libraries. Idea is, if you have a physical item that you no longer need, but that is good enough to be reused, you can pop it in a Give Box. We've got a smart electric van, so there's no emissions on the collections. collects all of those, brings them back here, and the team sort those, and we get them to 30 different local charities, all meeting specific needs for people experiencing material poverty across the city.
Now, a lot of churches are involved with essentially food banks.
Yeah.
But food banks traditionally can only deal with imperishables, so it's dried goods, it's tinned foods, kind of thing.
Yeah.
You've gone one step beyond that.
Yeah, so the relatively new concept is the community fridge, and I believe ours was roughly the 50th that opened in the UK through the community fridge network. And it's such a simple idea because it takes excess food from supermarkets that would have gone in the bin, and it makes it available to people who can use it. So we have two fridges, one freezer. We also take ambient goods, so a lot of bakery items that are same day. I think a unique thing as well is our ability to collect direct from stores. So again, using an electric van, we can pick up from supermarkets, convenience stores across the city. And it's everything that's within its use-by date. But a supermarket won't sell something after its best before, but we all know if we buy a loaf of bread, you can still eat it the next day.
There is a generational issue here too, because I mean, I'm a great believer in the Mark 1 nose. Mm-hmm. You know, sniff it if it feels okay. That's fine. That's, as long as it's not a different colour, then it's okay. But it's interesting, my daughters both hate that idea. Mm. You know, if it says a number on it, they stick by the number.
Yeah, and use-by is definitely a safety thing, and we operate by the same rules that supermarkets do. But Best Before is the one where some brands are recognising that Best Before actually leads to more food waste, and they're taking that off of some products and using common sense and looking at the bananas and going, yeah, they're fine, rather than relying on a date. But I can give you a little tour of the fridge.
Yeah, go on then. I was about to ask, actually, if it's in the building.
Just across the road.
Aye, okay.
So we deliberately put the community fridge in a public space. Uh-huh. So we leased the land from the local authority. It was just really wasteland at the side of a car park. But it's in a prime spot right on Dundee's Perth Road in the West End, which has a lot of passing traffic right by the uni campus. And it's open until 8 p.m. weekdays, 4 p.m. on weekends. And unlike food banks, it's not for a particular...
I was about to say, who can access it?
There's no criteria other than being a person who can use the food.
Okay.
I pop in there every day myself and take home something if it can save us buying it. And hundreds of other people do as well.
To a certain extent, you are exhibiting your faith by example.
Yeah, I mean, that's the practical outworking, isn't it? I think... local churches should be the centre of communities. They should do things that positively impact their city, positively impact their neighbours, without any agenda other than purely doing the right thing.
Yes.
So, yeah, this is the community fridge. It's an old shipping container that has been repurposed.
It's not a huge shipping container. It's quite a small one, really.
It is, yeah. Great local architects firm did all the design work for free for us. And Scottish Government's Climate Challenge Fund have grant-aided the project.
Aye, okay.
Along with some local businesses.
Yeah, okay. Let's go and have a shifty. Hello, how you doing?
Dear.
Thank you.
So here we go. Every day we have currently up to 100 kilos of food, which is a van load, donated to the fridge. And a little example, we've got some salad items here.
Bakery items. Lettuce bits and pieces, bakery items up there. You've got some bananas down here.
And then a frozen fridge. So when we get too much bakery items for the space available, we freeze some and people can take it home frozen.
So I'm talking to you mid to late afternoon.
That's right.
So most of this has been cleared out from yesterday's stock, and presumably... stock will come in again this afternoon.
All our stock is generally taken away same day. Okay. So other than frozen items, I guess demand is bigger than supply, which is great because it shows people are using the food waste. And we have to remember that everything that comes here would have otherwise went into food recycling or the bin. So it's really genuinely saving stuff from going to waste.
At other churches in Dundee looking at your example and thinking, we could do that.
We've talked to a lot of groups, actually, who are keen to launch their own community fridges. We also work with other churches and community groups across Dundee. The one
literally a few hundred metres down the road is a great example. They can pop in and help themselves to ingredients that they use in their community outreach events and some of their social action projects as well. So we have a little tick box. If people help themselves from the fridge, we just ask they record what they've taken. Mm-hmm. No names, just what it is, and whether it's for a household or for a community group.
Yeah.
Because we want that stuff to go wherever it can be used.
Going back to the old biblical quotation of faith, hope and charity, or faith, hope and love, depending on how you actually translate it, this isn't charity, this is common sense. This is not letting stuff go into waste.
Yeah, that's good. And it's, I think, a key thing as well is for anyone who is struggling and is, you know, experiencing hunger, for example, a lot of people can feel embarrassed or that there's potentially social stigma around accessing services that need referrals, etc. Whereas with a community fridge, you're coming in on the same basis as everyone else. And I feel like those that do need the help can receive it without needing to jump through any hoops, I guess. Little stat here as well. 1/3 of all food produced globally is never eaten, which is really, really
it's nearly
shocking.
Nearly 10%, it says here, of global greenhouse gas emissions. That is terrible.
That's right. That's right. So it's a big deal. And supermarkets are very keen to reduce food waste as well. And actually, they are doing a good job on that. And a community fridge is helping with the stuff that they can't get rid of to start with.
James Anthony from St Mark's Church in Dundee. Now, I like that idea because food banks can only cope with non-perishable foods.
Yeah,
tends to be
stuff, yeah.
Dried foods, pastas, rice, that kind of stuff, and tin foods. This opens up a whole new line. And because they're doing it in association with the supermarkets aren't putting it in the bin anymore. They're putting it across here. And folk can find a use for it.
Yeah, I just wonder, it's a fantastic idea and it's great, but is it not liable to open to abuse by people just going to the community fridge rather than going to the supermarket?
Possibly. Doesn't seem to be happening.
And hopefully it wouldn't. Yeah. And it's a great idea. Yeah. We've got a community fridge here at the BBC. But the people who put the butter in disagree.
There is that small issue. I recently visited the brand new Scottish Oceans Institute at St Andrews University. Now, the Institute is a world leader in the marine environment, and I asked Professor Vincent Yannick, director of the Institute, how broad a series of issues do you cover and where do you cover them?
We have a variety of topics that we work on. We also have quite a large geographic area that we cover. In terms of topics, the Scottish Oceans Institute is particularly well known for its very large marine mammal group. We have the largest marine mammal research group in the world. Geographically, it really is pretty much spans the world. So we are studying seals in the Arctic and Antarctic, but we also have people studying coral reefs around Australia and in the tropical seas. And really nowadays, marine sciences is so international because, of course, the seas themselves don't have any boundaries. And so we're going into different habitats, different climate areas where we kind of look at colder water organisms, tropical organisms at times, and depending on what the question is, really we go there and then see where we have the best access.
How much are people in the frame? People working with the sea, living beside the sea?
That's a really good point. So we also have a section in our School of Geography and Sustainable Development where we do have people studying the interactions of coastal communities with the sea and how they make best use of the sea, and then at the interaction. So how do people affect the oceans, but also how do the oceans affect people?
How good is Scotland a hub for doing something like this?
Well, half the people and half the time that people spend in terms of working in the field is in Scotland and the other half is international. So Scotland is a very good place to do marine sciences. It's a huge coastline and incredible biodiversity, marine biodiversity. Also in terms of the actual habitats, the kind of colder waters that are really very interesting, commercially very important, of course, nutrient-rich, so much larger fish densities than you have, for example, in tropical waters. And so therefore, yeah, Scotland is a fantastic hub, and that's one of the reasons why marine science has been active at the university here for so long and why one of the first marine centres was built here in St Andrews.
What is that new building going to do that wasn't already happening here before? Because I've been coming down here for probably 15, 20 years. What's going to change with the advent of that?
The new building has two real kind of functions, purposes. First of all, we were kind of a victim of our own success. We attracted so many different scientists that the existing facilities simply were too small. So one thing I'm very excited about is have everyone under one roof again, because as often in science in general, the real kind of innovation comes from people talking on a daily basis, often about completely different things, then getting diverted onto a subject that they're interested in. And this is how people interact and how we make new discoveries, have new ideas. And I think that that's very, very important. The other thing of equal importance, I think, is that we build a new aquarium. And this is now obviously the most recent, but also the most modern aquarium, experimental aquarium in the UK and one of the leading facilities worldwide. And the reason why that is important is we had before that, we had an old Victorian building, which we still used as an aquarium. And you can imagine temperature control, things like that in a Victorian building, not an easy thing to achieve. So for some of the work that we're doing, where we're looking specifically at how organisms react to very fine, very small changes in temperature, in pH, of the water, for example, you need very careful environmental control. And the new facility allows us to do just that. So it has a huge range and flexibility, so we can cool rooms down to 5 degrees or up to 30 degrees so that we can simulate water temperatures in different parts of the world. And then we are able to bring animals in and experimentally work with them and look at their reactions to these changes.
Give me an example of a species being affected by, you know, a marginal difference in temperature or pH.
One example of the effects of climate change that where relatively subtle changes can make a difference is when we look at sea turtles. An interesting phenomenon in these animals and also in some others is that the actual sex determination, whether offspring is male or female, is influenced by temperature. And interestingly, that threshold is something where when you have higher temperatures, you have more females. And when you have lower temperatures, you have more males. And this is an adaptation depending on the environment. Now, with global warming and increases in temperature, what happens is that you have more and more female offspring. And in fact, there are some predictions that for some turtles, like green turtles, as soon as, I think it was 2050, you would only have 1-2% of their offspring being male. Now, you can imagine what effect that would have on a population when there's effectively not enough males anymore to create new offspring. And that's a real concern, how these animals react to increases in temperature.
You can do the research. You can come up with some answers to some pretty complicated questions. How key is communicating that information to other people, people like me, lay people? Because, you know, we're standing here on the beach, beautiful sunny day, we're looking out on a fairly placid sea, but what we're looking at is the outside wall of 4/5 of the planet. I've no idea what's happening in there.
That's right. And I think communication is one of the most important parts. I think science kind of has woken up to the importance of that communication. Scientists in the past have often stayed within their own circles and published in scientific journals. I think communication is key. And the first communication is really the communication to regulators, to government, to kind of understand what the processes are. One of the things that we do in the Institute here is we're trying to understand mechanisms. We're trying to understand how exactly do animals react to these changes and why, and how does it affect how they live. And then, of course, from there, I need to communicate this, because someone who makes a decision on whether we are venturing into a new field to, for example, do deep sea mining or whatever it is, what effects will that have? And of course, then we come to the questions that are more on a society level. It's like, do we want to engage in this? Do we want to potentially have these effects? You know, everyone has a voice too. I think if there's concerns about environmental impacts, then they have to be voiced. And I think nowadays we have a much wider discussion in the general public about these issues than we used to. It's one of the key things for us, and especially saying that as somebody at a university, is education. I mean, we need to be informed and we need to know what the particular problems are. And I think it's also important to recognize that there is still a role for experts and to be able to find out and know, hold all that knowledge. But the role that the expert also has is to communicate that knowledge to the general public and inform them and you know, point out where perhaps there are misconceptions, but at the same time also support the general public in trying to find out about the natural world and trying to take a stand.
Professor Vincent Yannick, Director of the Scottish Oceans Institute. And given the fact that you found the Scotland Outdoors podcast, you might also like to know that there's a programme on Radio Scotland called Brainwaves. There will be a podcast up in there too, which also features Vincent, talking about what we can learn about the development of language and brain function by comparing ourselves to dolphins.
Such a big subject.
Huge subject. Yeah. I would have thought we wouldn't come out terribly well with a comparison with dolphins. They're bound to be much brighter than we are.
Well, certainly there's something about when you've got a dolphin looking at you, uh-huh, just inside the boat, and goodness me,
what's going on in your head.
Yeah,
I was watching them. We left recording last week's or the week before's programme. There was a pod of about six just down on the beach as I was driving home. People walking along completely oblivious to them.
Yes.
And they're kind of leaping out of the water saying, hello, see me. But it's a delightful sight. It's great.
Somebody showed me a video the other day, and it was somebody who was surfing, and the dolphins, as the guys on the board, they're paralleling him, you know, through and leaping out of the surf, out the same wave and what have you, in and out and in and out. Fantastic.
Wow.
Yeah. Anyway, earlier we heard about the whooper swans, which were just outside your house. Now, those swans will have come from Iceland to here.
Yeah, it was quite a sight, I'll tell you that. We've actually got pictures up on a wee video on Facebook, and you'll get some impression of the sounds and just the sight of these things. So, as it was so loud, and what it was, usually they're out in an open field, but this time they were right up against the forest, the woods. So I was able to get along the woods and get really, really close to them, and it's just, it's a great sign of winter. I was working away in my kitchen and then suddenly heard this incredible racket, and about 300 swans, whooper swans, have suddenly descended on a stubble field just at my back door. And I'm in the wood, but I'm about 20 feet from them. And what's amazing is there seems to be one in every group of 10 that's got its head up, watching every movement. All the rest are quietly grazing. They've only just arrived. I don't know how long they stay, but they're really quite an impressive sight. I don't want to disturb them, I just want to see how close they get. See what they sound like. A couple of geese in there, a couple of grey-lag geese. You've seen me now. A couple of young ones in there, they're just quietly walking away. Car going past, don't seem unfazed by that. Got all the heads up now. Most of it, I don't know much about whooper swans, where they come from, because they suddenly descend in these vast flocks for about a week, 10 days, before they head off somewhere. It's slightly unnerving having 300 pairs of eyes trained on you. Every now and again, one of them stands right up and flaps these massive wings. They don't look like they're going to fly away, and I'm not going to get any closer to make that happen. It's just wonderful when nature arrives in your doorstep. This is proper wildlife watching. Get out the back door and there it is.
now quietly waddled about 50 yards away. They were about 20 yards away to start. Some of them are starting to settle down to eat again. There's still about 100 with their heads up watching me. Really calming down now. There's about 10 of them left with their heads up. There's a wee group closest to me, all with their heads up. But the ones further away are getting back to the serious business of eating grass and barley. There's a couple doing that. I was going to say it's mating, but I think they're actually fighting. Flapping their wings, really standing up to each other. I don't know if this is mating or fighting, but they're moving their necks together. Heads going up and down. And look at it from the side, it makes a fantastic heart shape. As the heads are bowed, they just hunch down. It's the only ones in this whole flock that are doing it. Looks more like fighting, but well, it starts like fighting. They kind of chest to chest, throwing their weight around, and then the heads go up and down, forming that lovely heart shape, and it goes from aggression into what looks like affection. There's four of them in the far away, five of them in the far away field. I haven't disturbed them. It looks like they're coming in to join the rest of them, so let's see what happens. Don't know if you heard that there, but as they came in, they kind of banked like an aeroplane, feet right out, and then flapping the wings as they come and cruising over the barley, and you can hear that power. Well, this must be fighting actually, because the ones that have come in have gone into that heart shape, kind of manning up to each other. This is my field, get out. So I'm just going to let this run and enjoy the sounds of winter.
So if that's the sound that whooper swans make, what sound do mute swans make?
They do make a noise. They make a wee kind of honky noise.
Really?
Nothing like as loud as the whooper swans, but yeah, they do make a noise.
I've heard them hiss.
Yeah, no, they make a wee honky sound.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Fair enough.
But it's really, I mean, you and I have made wildlife programmes all over the world, and there's just something so satisfying about it arrives in your doorstep.
Yeah.
You don't have to travel thousands of miles.
Yeah.
And sometimes, I think we're guilty of not appreciating that.
Too straight. Sadly, that's all we've got time for in this week's Scotland Outdoors podcast. Thank you very much for downloading us. I'll leave you with the sound of the swans. Until the next one, from all the team here at BBC Aberdeen, thanks for listening. I'm going to go to the next one.